Bone-chilling greetings, everybody. Those tunes are courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away?
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from tropical paradise to the desolate desert, from the smallest of villages to the largest of cities and everything in between, it is greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Kenwood, Texas, Vincennes, Indiana, South Haven, Mississippi, St. Charles, Missouri, Asbestos, Canada, home to what was the biggest asbestos mine in the world. And that's before it was like, you know, what it is today, what we know what asbestos is today. And North Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, before we start, I just need to say that you may hear some booms and shakes, and it's not my sound effects. I am currently in North Carolina, right near Camp Lejeune, and those Marines are out and about and doing their thing. So, if you hear that, that's what it is. As if on cue. It's funny because I just re-listened to that little sound, and I mean, it was little on the recording, so I guess we have nothing to worry about, but it shook the house. Imagine yourself on a boat in the water. It's a beautiful day. There's a warm breeze that gently hits you. You hear the seabirds serenading you with their sounds and caws and songs in the distance. The sound of the water surrounding you as you ever so gently rock back and forth. You are in the presence of phenomenal company. Perhaps you have your favorite drink in hand. Laughter fills the air as someone cracks a joke. You are in a state of pure happiness and relaxation when suddenly your world is turned upside down and nobody is there to help you or hear you scream. In part one, I talked about the Bermuda Triangle dating back from 1492 until the end of the 1800s. Part two and three, well, that was based on the 1900s. And this final episode, for now, of the Bermuda Triangle series will be about the 2000s. So buckle up and pray that we get out of the Bermuda Triangle unscathed. Here we go. April 9th, 2000. The Gran Rio R was a Rambaran vessel, and it was 230 feet, owned and operated by Dennis Rambaran. With nine men on board, the freighter arrives at the port of Scarborough and is cleared by immigration officials. Now, after leaving Scarborough, it should have taken less than 2 hours, probably closer to an hour and a half, to arrive to their destination, back home. If they didn't run into any hiccups or bumps, that was. Well, obviously that did happen. Something happened because they never arrive and they're never seen or heard from again. They had sailed from Guyana and vanished somewhere from the West Indies. To this day, its final resting place remain a mystery. August 14th, 2000. A fishing vessel named Hemingway is found abandoned. The captain and crew missing. What happened to the men remain a mystery to this day. June 22nd, 2001. A boat called the Tropic Bird is found abandoned and in horrible shape in Antigua. What happened to it, to be that way, or where its occupants went, remain a mystery today. September 23rd, 2002. Around 2.5 years after the Grand Rio R vanishes without a trace, another Rambaran freighter, the Fiona R, owned and operated by Chandrama Rambaran, vanishes. Her and four people, they are traveling to St. Vincent, and they go missing off the West Indies and are never seen or heard from again. June 18th, 2003. A couple from West Palm Beach get into their 16-foot boat and go for a ride and vanish. The couple and the boat, never seen or heard from again. August 3rd, 2003. A sailing yacht called the Wind Home leaves Beaufort, North Carolina to travel to Azores a little over a week ago. But they never arrive, and they're reported overdue. What happened to Windholm and its unknown number of occupants? Anyone's guess today. August 25th, 2003. Just 2 weeks after Windholm vanishes. 2 weeks, mind you. A 32-foot white fiberglass vessel called Sleek Go Fast, with three men on board, vanished somewhere in the Bahamas. What exactly happened that day remains a mystery. Late October 2003, three people go onto a fishing boat called What's Left and go for a fishing trip in the Florida Keys. What's Left is discovered in Cape Canaveral, and its condition is concerning. It's capsized. The body of the owner, a man named Gary, is found on board. The other two people were nowhere to be found. What's Left was found over 400 miles from the area it was actually last seen. How Gary met his fate, or what happened to the other two people, remain a mystery. March 23, 2004. Glenn Jameson takes his 19-foot fishing boat out for a day of relaxation and fishing, hoping to get some nice big fish. But he never comes back, and his boat would be found. But Glenn, sadly, was nowhere to be seen, and he remains a missing person to this very day. December 21st, 2004. A fishing boat called the Fishing Yola was found, anchored and abandoned off Puerto Rico. Its fisherman, Anibal Matias, was nowhere to be seen. And to this day, what happened to him that fateful day remains a mystery. June 20th, 2005. A Piper PA-23 is carrying three people on board and vanishes without a trace. January 2nd, 2006. A gentleman named James Trindade. He leaves the Bahamas and is headed back to the United States when he vanishes without a trace. And in this specific case, foul play is suspected. You see, the possible suspects for the disappearance of James is a couple named Roger and Peggy Gamblin. Now, Roger and Peggy, they were a match made in hell. They were low-life thieves who took pleasure in pilfering $10 million from their own title company. Peggy and Roger at one time were extremely close friends with the now missing and presumed dead man, James. And it is believed they are the reason why he disappeared or have knowledge of what exactly took place that day. James's family believes possibly that they were out on the water and maybe a drug deal had gone bad and James was shot. Palm Beach Post reported this, quote, Jimmy Trindade, a larger-than-life figure whose reputation for toughness rivaled Hemingway's, was at the helm of a 38-foot Donzi when he disappeared, leaving nothing behind but a ghost boat circling in the open water, unquote. Roger and Peggy knew that they were wanted people, and they make a run for it. And they go to Colorado, and it is here in Colorado where they are eventually apprehended by the police. Now, sadly, Roger wouldn't even spend one entire month behind bars as he dies from heart complications. Now, you gotta love this, though. Ironically, it was because of his heart that he was arrested. Yeah, thanks to his trusted pacemaker. I quote the Palm Beach Post as they give more information. Quote, "They remained on the run for 2.5 years, living as Ron and Nancy in a remote part of Durango, Colorado, until one day last month when Gamblin checked into a hospital with heart trouble. The doctor scanned his pacemaker to retrieve programmed information, learned his patient's true name, and called the authorities," unquote. I love that. That'd be a really good movie, right? Like, this guy's pilfering money and, you know, federal fraud and all this stuff. And let's not forget the big one, possibly murdering somebody. And then, boom, you're on the run, think you got away with it. Oh, my heart's giving me problems. Guess what? Haha, now I'm captured. Yeah. So he got off very easy, if you ask me. I know my opinion doesn't really matter, but, you know, if he's not responsible for the death and disappearance of James, which too many people think he is, let's be honest, he is absolutely guilty of federal fraud. 10 million big ones, baby. In the same Palm Beach Post article I just read from, they do mention the missing man James Trindade. Quote, "The Gamblin's arrest last month also has rekindled interest in the fate of Roger's best friend, Jimmy Trindade. 54 years old, disappeared while driving a speedboat between Palm Beach County and the Bahamas, prompting Gamblin to bankroll a frantic and expensive search for his friend. But in the years since he vanished, the friendship between the Trindades and the Gamblins gave way to tension and finally, suspicion, largely because Gamblin's son, Chris, and another man were boating alongside Trindade when he disappeared. Presumably, they were the last people to see him alive," unquote. To this day, James Trindade remains a missing person. What exactly happened that fateful day in January of 2006 remains a complete and utter mystery. July 4th, 2006. An 18-foot boat belonging to Richard Perez is found in the Florida Keys, but he is nowhere to be found. Important items were left behind on the boat, including a wallet and keys, among other things. To this day, Richard Perez remains a missing person. March 2nd, 2007. A Boston Whaler is found, abandoned, and its owner, Michael Carlo, is nowhere to be found. Michael's body would later be found off Anclote Key. What exactly happened that day remains a mystery, but at least this is a rare case where a body is actually found. Hopefully giving, I hate to say the word closure, right? But at least, if not answers to family and friends of Michael, at least a final known resting place for them to visit Michael. March 15th, 2007. Less than 2 weeks after Michael Carlo's body was found, a 25-foot pleasure craft is taken out for a day of fishing by Steve Seneca and never returns. The boat is eventually found 27 miles from St. Augustine, Florida, but what happened to Steve Seneca remains a mystery to this very day. October 19th, 2007. A 37-foot boat named Tranquility is found abandoned. Ulysses Didier, the owner, was nowhere to be found. His last log in his book was 4 days earlier, saying that he was going to be anchoring. What exactly took place that day remains a mystery. March 16, 2008. A 28-foot watercraft containing 3 fishermen goes missing without a trace. April 17, 2008. A boat called Don Chepo leaves the Virgin Islands and is headed to Puerto Rico, and is ultimately found abandoned. Personal belongings were found on the board, but it was things that people just wouldn't leave behind, like 2 cell phones. And other things were flares, life jackets, etc. June 17, 2008, Marcos Aguiles hops on his 22-foot boat called the Holokiki, goes for a cruise, never returns. September 5th, 2008. A 25-foot sailboat is discovered and abandoned. Its owner, a gentleman named Stephen Nelson, is nowhere to be found, and Stephen remains a missing person today. March 2009, a 40-foot gaff catch named the Lili Ulala departs from South Carolina, and it's headed to the Bahamas, but never arrives. Neither a watercraft or the unknown number of occupants aboard are never seen again. June 2009. Three fishermen are in their 22-foot Grady White fishing boat and go missing in Puerto Rico, never seen or heard from again. Mark Portis takes his 22-foot boat out for a day of fishing, and he never returns. His body would be found a few days later. What exactly took place that day, which resulted in his death, remains a mystery. September 20th, 2009. A little over a month after Mark went missing and was found dead, a woman named Paula Migliorni and her beloved dog go for a ride in her 16-foot boat. What exactly took place that day remains a mystery, but what is known is her boat was found abandoned, with the dog on board. But Paula, nowhere to be found. Her body would later be discovered on Hudson Beach. December 13th, 2009. Two men are in a 17-foot Largo pleasure craft and are en route to Bimini, and they vanish without a trace. July 2015. Two teenagers named Austin and Perry, both 14 years old at the time of their disappearance, go out for a fishing trip on their 19-foot fishing boat and vanish. These two young men were very good friends and both enjoyed fishing and spending time together, and they would often go on fishing trips together. They would do this countless times with no events, nothing to write home about, everything in perfect order. Austin had operated this particular boat many, many times. If I remember correctly, it was his grandfather's boat. And for a young man, he was really good at it. In fact, a few days before the two boys would vanish, Austin was driving it when he was stopped by a Marine Patrol officer. It was nothing serious. He wasn't doing anything wrong. In fact, it was just a routine check to make sure that everything was copacetic and working order, which it was. All safety equipment that was needed was on the fishing boat, and everything was perfect. What would be their last night, unbeknownst to them, their family, or the community, was normal. The boys had a sleepover, as the next day they were planning a trip, a fishing trip, which would take them to the Bahamas. That night, they were out on the water. Storms have plagued the area with rain and high wind, unfortunately. And they had been on Jupiter Island, and one of the last Snapchat activity from Austin and Perry are on the boat with their fishing poles, and Austin is saying,
"Peace out, Jupe."
Someone shared that they actually saw the final video while the storm was closely coming towards the boys. And Austin said,
"We're fucked."
The boat was found a few days later. The search party had put a data marker buoy on it, then continued with their search for the two teenage boys. Again, just 14 years old. So sad. And the boat wouldn't be found again until the following year. On board were the boys' belongings, including an iPhone. But sadly, neither Austin nor Perry have ever been found. The boat was found off the coast of Bermuda. The search for the young men, it was massive. It was being conducted by the Coast Guard, Customs and Border Protection, pilots, private boats, authorities, and locals all participated in this huge grand search covering over 15,000 square nautical miles. Even Joe Namath took part in the search, but no luck whatsoever. This is completely heartbreaking, where two young men were out doing what they loved to do the most, being in each other's company, and going on what they were hoping would be an epic fishing trip. And it just ends in complete and utter heartbreak and mystery. Now, sadly, I mean, everything about this is sad, obviously, but this tragedy, it should have brought these two families, that of Austin and Perry, together, closer together, as their dear sons were so incredibly close themselves. But one family, not going to mention which one, felt that there was a way that this could have been avoided and took the other family to court with a wrongful death suit. Insult to injury, man. I mean, it's very heartbreaking. Each family lost a young son. And in my opinion, which again, I know doesn't matter in the slightest here, they most likely were hit with that horrible storm and there's nothing that could have been done. There's no wrongful death. The fact is that two young men who had gone fishing together how many times and always came back home safely, went out one fateful day for a trip to the Bahamas to fish, and a terrible storm tagged along, and they knew that they were in trouble, as the last thing known for them to say was,
"We're fucked."
To this day, neither young man has ever been found. My thoughts and prayers go out to their families. October 1st, 2015. The SS El Faro was a cargo ship which had left Jacksonville, Florida, and was on its way to San Juan, Puerto Rico. It is believed to have fallen victim when it was encountered by Hurricane Joaquin, which at the time was a Category 4 hurricane. When they had left at the time, though, it was just a tropical storm, but had sadly upgraded majorly and strengthened to horrific levels during their travels. Hurricane Joaquin would wreak havoc in the Bahamas, the Turks and Caicos Islands, the Greater Antilles, Bermuda, Cuba, Haiti, Morocco, both North and South Carolina, and this resulted in 34 known deaths and over $200 million in damages. On October 3rd, just 2 days after they had left Jacksonville, Florida, a life buoy of theirs was found. 33 crew members were on board and presumed dead. Now, 2.5 months after the SS El Faro and its 33 occupants vanish, the NTSB released a transcript of the final day of their lives. It contains 500 pages, and some of that content is severely haunting. The last 26 hours of their lives was recorded, and what I'm going to be talking about and what you'll be hearing is some of the things said on the recordings, things that we otherwise would not know or have knowledge about. Hurricane Joaquin was a force not to be reckoned with. At one point, the third mate receives the most current weather forecast, and it showed the hurricane barreling right towards them going 100 miles per hour. In the third mate's own words,
"The hurricane is advancing toward our track line, and it puts us real close to it."
The third mate had calculated that by 4 a.m. the SS El Faro would be 22 miles from the center of the storm, which at that time would be at a whopping 120 miles per hour. The second mate could be heard sharing his frustration.
"Every time we come further south, the storm keeps trying to follow us."
And at 1:15 a.m., the satellite radio news bulletin announces haunting news. Hurricane Joaquin has just been upgraded to a deadly Category 3. This is not what the men wanted to hear in the slightest. I'm sure at this point they felt like a tiny terrified mouse, cornered by an ever so ferocious cat, waiting to strike, perhaps batting here and swiping there, nipping there at the defenseless rodent. But instead of a feline and its claws and teeth, it's 33 men stuck in the Bermuda Triangle, getting hit by rogue waves and being thrown all about like a rag doll. With this upsetting news, the second mate could be heard saying,
"Oh my God."
At 2:48 a.m., the second mate and a junior crew member are recorded discussing the events taking place.
"That was a doozy. That was not a good one."
Yeah, that was a big wave.
We won't be able to take more of those.
Second Mate Randolph, he had voiced concern to Captain Davidson that they should be possibly changing routes and go through the Crooked Island Passage. Randolph also emailed family and friends saying that there was a hurricane out there and we are headed straight into it. At 6:54 a.m., Captain Davidson is recorded saying this.
It's miserable right now. We got all the wind on the starboard side here. Now, a scuffle was left open, or popped open, or whatever, so we got some flooding in the three hold. It's definitely a significant amount. Everybody's safe right now, and we're not going to abandon ship. We're going to stay with the ship. We're in dire straits right now. Okay. I'm going to call the office, and I'm going to tell them. Okay. There's no need to ring the general alarm yet. We're not abandoning ship. The engineers are trying to get the plant back. So we're working on it, okay?
At 7:06 a.m., 12 minutes after the captain had just mentioned not ringing the general alarm yet, he makes this request.
I have a marine emergency and I'd like to speak with a qualified individual. We had a hull breach, a scuttle blew open during the storm. We have water down in the tree hold. We have a heavy list. We've lost the main propulsion unit. The engineers cannot get it going. Can I speak with a QI, please?
The last conversations to be recorded was between the captain and his able seaman, number one.
Help me! Help me!
AB1, don't panic. Don't panic. Work your way up here.
I can't!
AB1.
Help me!
You're okay. Come on, don't freeze up. Where are the life preservers? Hey, don't panic. Where are the life preservers on the bridge? Go ahead and grab one. We have to wear one. Follow me.
I can't!
Yes, you can.
My feet are slipping. Going down.
You're not going down. Come on.
I need a ladder.
We don't have a ladder.
A line!
I don't have a line.
You're gonna leave me?
I'm not leaving you. Let's go.
I need someone to help me. You don't want to help me?
I'm the only one here.
I can't. I can't. I'm a goner.
No, you're not.
Just help me.
AB1, let's go.
Very, very heartbreaking indeed. And then this is followed by yelling. Then in the transcripts, words, quote, sound of building word frequency rumble until end of recording. And it ends with Captain Davidson yelling to his able seaman.
It's time to come this way.
Mind you, this all happened October 1st. The following day, the ship was declared missing. A gigantic search took place, including the United States Coast Guard, the United States Air Force, the United States Navy, and the Air National Guard. During the search, they did find one body, but they sadly were unable to retrieve it. And by October 5th, the SS El Faro was declared sunk. During the grand search, over 183,000 square miles was covered. On October 19th, just 18 days after the SS El Faro and 33 men disappeared, the Navy conducted an underwater search with their USNS Apache, a fleet ocean tugboat, and they did succeed in finding a wreckage. And 30 days after the disappearance, October 31st, yes, Halloween Day, talk about haunting and spooky, they were able to identify the wreckage they had found. And indeed, it was the SS El Faro. The following day, a submersible went down taking photos of the shipwreck that was SS El Faro. 18 out of the 33 victims' families settled with lawsuits consisting over $7 million. April 15th, 2017, a Mitsubishi MU-2B carrying Nathan Ulrich, the pilot, who actually had flown for the Coast Guard auxiliary for over 9 years, a woman named Jennifer Blumen, who was a CEO of Skylight Group from New York City, and her two young sons, aged 3 and 4, leave Puerto Rico and vanish somewhere near the Bahamas. ASN.flightsafety.org gives a good account of what took place that fateful day. Quote, "The commercial pilot and 3 passengers were making a personal cross-country flight over ocean waters in the airplane. During cruise flight at flight level 240, the airplane maintained the same relative heading, airspeed, and altitude for about 2.5 hours before radar contact was lost. While the airplane was in flight, a significant meteorological information notice was issued that warned of frequent thunderstorms with tops of flight level 440 in the accident area at the accident time. Satellite imagery showed cloud tops in the area were up to flight level 400. Moderate or greater icing conditions and super cold large drops were likely near or over the accident area at the accident time. Although the wreckage was not located for examination, the loss of the airplane's radar target, followed by the identification of debris and a fuel sheen on the water below the last radar target location, suggests that the airplane entered an uncontrolled descent after encountering adverse weather and impacted the water." Unquote. Now, sadly, it is believed that this is pilot error. Nathan had known the weather would not be good and that icy conditions did exist, but he decided to choose the specific route anyways, and sadly, it proved to be fatal for him, his girlfriend Jennifer, and her 2 very young children. In the final report, this is what was said. Quote, "The National Transportation Safety Board determines the probable causes of this accident to be the pilot's intentional flight into an area of known icing and convective thunderstorm activity, which resulted in a loss of control of the airplane, personnel issues, several on the now deceased pilot, identification and recognition, decision-making, a judgment, weather planning, and total experience and lack of sleep." Unquote. The Coast Guard did discover a debris field in this case. May 2021. A twin engine carrying 4 people leave Puerto Rico and was en route to Florida when tragedy strikes and they never make it to their destination. Debris would later be found. I hope you enjoyed this mini-series of the Bermuda Triangle. Covered during these 4 episodes were several disappearances regarding aircraft and watercraft. I myself had gone through the Bermuda Triangle at one point during a cruise to the Bahamas, and I would be lying if a little paranoia did not go through my mind when we were on that cruise ship. As I thought about all the people that have vanished throughout the centuries in the Bermuda Triangle, while it was beautiful, no doubt about it, the thought did not escape my mind of all the missing souls who breathed their last breath here, and I prayed for all of those lost and missing, and for their families as well. Discussed in this final Bermuda series episode is the following: Gran Rio R, Hemingway, Tropic Bird, Fiona R, 16-foot boat, Windholm, Sleek Go Fast, What's Left, a 19-foot fishing boat, Fishing Yola, a Piper PA-23, Jim's Tridade's boat, an 18-foot boat, Boston Whaler, a 25-foot pleasure craft, Tranquility, 28-foot boat, Don Chepo, Holo Kiki, sailboat, Lili Ulala, Grady White fishing boat, 22-foot boat, a 16-foot boat, a 19-foot boat, Largo pleasure craft, the SS El Faro, Mitsubishi MU-2B, and a twin-engine plane. This resulted in at least 87 deaths, with at least 5 accounts not sharing the number of people on board. So obviously the number's much higher. A big shout out to Bryce Kolb, who portrayed Austin and Able Seaman number 1. Jerry Cooper as SSL Pharaoh third mate. Jerry Morrow as SSL Pharaoh second mate Randolph. Justin Dean as SSL Pharaoh junior crew. And Sean Curtis as SSL Pharaoh Captain Davidson. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others, they're all awesome. Haven't heard every single one yet? Don't fret, you can binge listen to your heart's fright and delight by hitting up any of those spectacular podcast platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Downcast, Player FM, Deezer. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thank you for lending me your ears, and I will
see you next week.